welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight, we have Kate Feibusch as our guest. Kate is a doctor, parent, and resident of Sonoma County. She was born in San Francisco and went to high school in the South Bay. She earned her undergrad at UC Santa Cruz, her master's in public health at UC Berkeley, and attended UC San Francisco for medical school. She came to Sonoma County for her residency in family medicine and graduated in 1999. After spending a year doing a fellowship in HIV medicine, she took a two-year volunteer position working to train community health workers in rural Guatemala. 2 years turned into 12, and she returned to Sonoma County in 2012 to make a life for herself and her two daughters.
Kate joined Kaiser Permanente as a family physician in the bilingual unit La Clinica, where she also teaches third-year medical students. She became involved with the new Kaiser Santa Rosa Family Medicine Residency as the Community Medicine Curriculum Director. In 2017, she founded the nonprofit organization called Peten Health, which is dedicated to supporting the team of Guatemalan community health workers that she still has close contact with. Her daughters attend Windsor High School and are now in 11th and 12th grade. Oh my gosh, we are so happy to have you join us tonight, Kate. Thank you so much for joining.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
We have lots to learn about Kate and her life. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Moralvia.
I'd love to change the world.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of September 6th, 2020. Two federal appeals courts panels have ruled that a landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision prohibiting discrimination against LGBT people at work also applies to discrimination at school. In Bostock v. Clayton, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in June that Title VII of the Federal Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in employment, includes discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation. And this month, two federal appeals panels cited Bostock in holding that Title IX of the Federal Education Amendments Act, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in federally funded schools, also prohibits discrimination based on gender identity. The two new rulings came from the Fourth Circuit and Eleventh Circuit Court of Appeals involving cases in Virginia and Florida where public high schools refused to allow transgender boys to use the boys' restroom. Both appeals panels found that the refusal of the schools to allow transgender boys to use the boys' restrooms violated the students' U.S. constitutional right of equal protection and Title IX of the Education Amendments Act. The stories of both transgender students, Gavin Grimm in Virginia and Drew Adams in Florida, are relatively similar. Both had been identified as female at birth, but experienced a lifelong sense that they were male. Both sought and received help from their parents and medical experts. Both transitioned to live as males, and both had their driver's licenses and birth certificates amended to indicate they are male. Interestingly, in the case of Adams, the school district in St. Johns County had adopted a policy requiring teachers to address LGBTQ students by their preferred names and pronouns and promoted other LGBTQ-sensitive rules around attire, bullying, and privacy. Both cases were decided by a three-judge panel and now could be appealed all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And 28-year-old Adrian Tam, who's running for the Hawaii State House of Representatives, is on his way to become the only out LGBTQ elected official in the entire state. On August 8th, Tam won the Democratic primary for District 22, defeating incumbent Tom Bauer, who had represented the district since 2006. This November, Tam will now face off with Republican Nicholas Oates. And here in California, our state could soon become the first in the nation to require healthcare providers to track the toll of COVID-19 and all other communicable diseases in the LGBTQ community. State legislators voted unanimously last week to pass Senate Bill 932, proposed by Senator Scott Wiener, which would require healthcare workers to ask patients infected with COVID-19 and about 90 other diseases about their sexual orientation and gender identity. The California Department of Health Services didn't start requiring healthcare providers to gather data on LGBT people until this last July. Senator Wiener said LGBTQ people are particularly vulnerable because of underlying health problems such as a higher prevalence of HIV, some cancers, and respiratory problems. The bill now goes to Governor Newsom, who has until September 30th to sign it. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. But I don't know
what to do. And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diane and Sheridan. In studio, we have Kate Feibusch, a resident doctor, founder of Patan Health, and parent of two teenagers. We want to thank you again for taking your time out of your busy schedule, Kate, to join us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure.
So, yeah, Kate, it's so nice to have you here. We have many, many questions that we want to learn about you because, I mean, as a doctor working at Kaiser, and 2020 came, COVID, you know, this pandemic that we're in. And so we want to learn about that. We want to learn about parenting. We want to learn about just, you've got so much. I mean, we heard your bio, right? And your bio was like a lot, but I know that was just probably half of it. So anyways, let's start with the COVID and how are you handling it as a doctor? What are you seeing? What can you share with us? That'd be great.
So COVID hit in March, hit the United States in March. In February, we were in Guatemala inaugurating a clinic and training center that Patan Health had spent 3 years building. So it was the culmination of 3 years of very hard work, and it was a very exciting time. And we inaugurated on February 28th, and we came back to this country and everything locked down. And now I'm not sure exactly when I'll be able to go back to Guatemala. So that was a huge shift because over the past 7 years, I've been going back to Guatemala 2 and 3 times a year, and now I can't go. So that's a big shift. So all my work in Guatemala has gone virtual as well. I'm still in contact with the team down there, but all virtually. In terms of my work at Kaiser, we shifted very quickly to telehealth. As I'm sure most people know, that most medicine now is being done via telephone and video. Kaiser was pretty well equipped to do that, so we made that shift pretty quickly. COVID has hit the Latino community very hard, much harder than average. So it's also hit our patients in La Clinica within Kaiser Permanente. So we've been doing a lot of talking to people on the phone, counseling them about their risks, figuring out if it's time to do a test, figuring out if the symptoms that they're experiencing might be COVID, talking to them about how to stay safe, if they have COVID, how to not infect their family. It just goes on and on. So we've been busy.
Do you find it different between the Latino community and other communities as far as COVID and doing all of the things that you just described?
Yeah, it's very different. The Latino community, well, all communities of color have been hit disproportionately. In Sonoma County, that's primarily the Latino community. And there's a few different things that go into that. One is that Latinos are more likely to be essential workers, so they're more likely to be out and about despite the pandemic, whereas more Anglos can work from home. That's not typically the type of job that Latinos have on average. So they're more likely to be out and about. They're more likely to have to go to work in order to put food on the table. They're more likely to live in crowded situations. So, you know, if one person does get sick or does get exposed, it's pretty hard to isolate from the other people that you live with, living with large numbers of people. And those are all the negatives, but I also think there's a positive in the Latino community, which I really love, and you know, a part of what I valued for the last 20 years is the sense of family and how important family is in the Latino community. And that, generally speaking, is a huge advantage. You know, we see among the Anglo population, we often see people elders living alone with far-flung family, but you know, never see that in the Latino community. People always live with family, and that's a real positive, but in this case, it's a negative in that it's really hard to socially distance from, you know, your uncle when he comes over because he's family, but maybe in this situation of the pandemic, you need to. So we're having to do a lot of counseling and kind of negotiating about harm reduction to try to keep people as safe as possible.
That's very interesting because, I mean, it's a real cultural phenomenon that folks in the Latino community live together, close-knit family. You wouldn't find someone living alone. How do you go about telling them and counseling them and advising them that it's not a good idea sometimes to be together?
I mean, people really value their families and they value keeping their families safe. And so you come at it from that angle, then people are willing to listen. And I've actually learned a lot from a group called IsoCare, which was started by another doctor in Sonoma County. It's a grassroots group that calls people at home and does kind of harm reduction, like talks through, you know, well, so if you have to share a bathroom with five people, you know, how are you going to go about keeping those other four people safe? So you just, you know, discuss the timing of things and, you know, when you're going to use a mask and when you're going to wash your hands and when you're going to wipe down the faucets and things like that.
Yeah, so it sounds like your work is more of counseling and getting people to follow the rules and so forth, more than seeing them as patients. That's what I'm hearing.
Well, that's what I was telling you about. We do a little bit of everything. We certainly talk to people that who are sick as well, sick with COVID or sick with anything else. I mean, just because COVID hit doesn't mean that all the other illnesses stopped happening. So we're dealing with everything. The shift is that the vast majority of what we're doing is over the phone now.
Well, I want to just take a moment to congratulate you for all the work that you did in Guatemala. I mean, that's a big deal, right? Because you say you've
Thank
been.
Thank you.
Yeah. You want to say more about that? I mean, how did you get involved, Kate? I'm just curious to learn more about that journey.
How did I get involved in Guatemala?
Yeah.
I graduated from residency and looked around Sonoma County at the time, and there was no particular job that I wanted to say, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do for the next 30 years of my life. And so I took a year fellowship in HIV medicine and jobbed around a little bit. And then I was looking on the very rudimentary 2000 internet and searched up international opportunities, and this one popped up. And my partner at the time and I decided that we could do this. And so we applied and they took us and down we went and we both loved it. And that's how 2 years turned into a lot longer than that.
And you had your kids with you?
This is where it gets complicated. The kids that are legally mine and live under my roof were not born yet when we went down. We went down with her child, who was 7 at the time and is now 26.
Oh, okay.
So the three of us went down to Guatemala in the year 2000. And then after 2 years, my daughter Toby was born.
Kate, were you already bilingual at that time?
I spoke some Spanish. I functioned in Spanish. I wouldn't call myself bilingual at the time.
So you went down to Guatemala with functional Spanish, and you needed to immerse yourself quite quickly, right? How did you learn to be fluent? Yeah. How what was your process?
The person that we were staying with, the other American who, the other person that was working in medicine, who we went to work with, went on vacation and left us in charge. And so that was it. We were on our own. That was about 3 weeks in. She had been by herself for a number of years, and she was ready to get out of Dodge. So.
Wow, that takes courage. I mean, you had courage anyways to take that trip and decide to look online and say, hey, this is what I want to do, and then take a chance, take a risk, and look what happened. Wow. Courageous women.
It was probably the best move that I've made in my life. Well, one of the best.
I'm really sorry, both of us are, that you're not able to go down there right now.
I'm in fairly constant contact. I mean, several times a week I'm talking to the team down there. So eventually I'll get back there.
What does your organization do down there? I mean, I know it's a health clinic, but who do you see? What type of clients or patients?
Well, more what I do is I train community health workers. So people who are campesinos, who are farm workers or subsistence farm workers living in very small villages at a distance of anywhere from 2 to 8 hours from the nearest hospital. They volunteer to undergo a training, a 3-year training program, and I basically teach them how to be, the Chinese call them barefoot doctors, but we call them promotores or community health workers. So they basically get taught to provide medical care in their villages. So depending on the need and the ability of the person that is studying or working, it can be simple things like dealing with diarrhea or asthma, or it can be chronic medical conditions like diabetes and hypertension. There's a lot of suturing because people work in the fields and there's a lot of injuries. And then the really super advanced ones can actually do tendon repairs because we tried sending these cases to the hospital, which was years ago, tried sending people to the hospital and they would come back without their tendons repaired. So and telling us that the doctors there hadn't even looked, hadn't tried to repair the tendon. And so I thought, well, we can do better than not trying. So we bought pig's feet and cut the tendons on the pig's feet and we read up on the procedure and taught ourselves how to repair tendons. There's a handful of very good surgeons down there who have 8th grade education.
That's amazing. And this is just volunteer. Is this a paid position or is it just helping the community out? I mean, as a community health worker.
Yeah, so the work that they do in their villages is volunteer. We supply them with medicines and people pay for the medicines at cost, which as it turns out, medicines on the world market are very inexpensive, not like what we get here in the United States, to the extent that world farmers can pay for those medicines without much difficulty. So people pay for the medicines at cost, and then the work of the community health worker in the villages volunteer. We also run, I should say, they also run a clinic, which has gone through 4 different sites, same clinic, but 4 different sites, and now is in its permanent home. And when a community health worker leaves their village to staff the clinic for a day, they do get a stipend for that work.
That's amazing. I'm just really blown away at your drive and your tenacity and your big heart. I mean, are you funded in any way? It's all volunteer for you? I mean, are you like do fundraising?
I do lots of fundraising. So I was all about education and medical care until the end of 2016. So my piece of it was all about training the community health workers and providing some direct medical care myself. But then in 2016, it kind of occurred to me that I was now an established doctor in Sonoma County and I could probably kick in financially as well. And so I founded a nonprofit called Paten Health. Paten is the name of the state that we work in. It would be like saying California Health. Paten is the state in Guatemala that our project is in. And I got a book out of the library and listened to a bunch of podcasts and figured out how to start a nonprofit and then listened to more podcasts and figured out how to fundraise and kept fundraising. So once I had the nonprofit established, I talked to the team. I said, okay, so what are the priorities? And they said, well, what we really need is a center of our own. And I was like, yeah, okay, yeah, that's nice. But what else are the priorities? They're like, no, that's what we really want. And that I didn't anticipate starting that enormous project. But that's what they identified as their need because they kept having to move from place to place and they really wanted a permanent home. So they looked for land and they found a plot of land and we figured out that we could afford the plot of land from between what they had and what I had. What Paten Health had. And then we started designing the buildings and we have one teaching building and a clinic building as well. And we just little by little over the course of 3 years.
Congratulations.
Amazing. Wow.
That is fabulous.
I'm like starstruck. I mean, you just went for it and did this beautiful thing. I mean, Kate, that's like, wow.
So before we leave Paten Health, does Paten Health have a website where people could go and learn more about you?
Absolutely. It's PETEN, like Peter, but with an N, health.org. And tells the story of how the clinic was built and tells a little bit about the community health workers. I should say I've had a lot of help along the way. Like people, the universe sends me good people. The Penn Health has a board. There's a few people that are just incredibly dedicated at helping me with the things that I'm not so good at myself, like the database and the website. And then the first building, the teaching building, the team and I pretty much designed ourselves. And it's great. We love it. And there was just one error in it that made us realize that we were not up for designing the clinic ourselves. And so when it came time to design the clinic, I put out on Facebook that I needed a structural engineer or an architect or something like that. And my daughter's drama teacher said that she thought she might know somebody. And I think you actually know her as well, the person that volunteered to help us, Dr. Lucas Plum, who's a psychologist in Santa Rosa. Her previous career was an architect, and she paid her own way down to Guatemala and met with the team. She was perfect. She used her psychology skills and met with the team and figured out exactly what their needs were and what their desires were. And she stayed up all night, three nights in a row, and designed this amazing building that we then spent the next year building. So.
Amazing. What a gift.
So, yeah, no, I don't know where we would be without Lucas.
Wow, I love hearing that story. I've not known that about you. Pretty amazing, Kate.
That's great.
So do you see yourself being involved in Paten Health for your whole rest of your life or as long as you're working? Or what's in the future?
And I'm rewriting my will even as we speak, and I'm putting Paten Health in my will so that, yeah, I mean, I hope it's been, I mean, besides my kids, this is like my greatest work. And so, yeah, as long as I'm able to keep this going, I will, and I hope I'll be able to pass it on to whoever comes next, because the need is certainly not going to go away. I mean, the need for health care in this rural area, it doesn't look like the Guatemalan government is going to step up to take care of the rural poor. So they've got to be able to take care of themselves. So Paten Health is my way of helping them do that.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story, and you've touched many, many lives over all these many, many years. So, yeah. Your legacy, part of it.
I don't know their politics regarding gay people down in Guatemala. I'm wondering if you being a lesbian was an issue or a non-issue, or can you talk a little bit about that?
I think it felt like what it would have been like here in the 30s and 40s. When I was living there with my partner, I think anybody who thought about it would have realized that we were a couple. Most people, I think, didn't think about it, but nobody asked about it. So she and I lived there together for 8 years, and we lived in the same house, and we raised our children together, and that was obvious, but some people didn't understand that we were partners. They just thought we were good friends, or they thought we were sisters, or they thought we were nuns, which was interesting, but most of the time people just didn't ask.
So because you compared it to here in the 30s and 40s, I'm thinking that if they did find out, it may have been not the safest place for you?
I think we had a fair amount of white privilege. You know, we were clearly there. We weren't from there. We were obviously helping. We helped everyone and didn't ask for their credentials, so they didn't ask for our credentials.
That's pretty amazing. I bet you guys learned how to cook some great food.
And ate some great food.
A lot of beans and tortillas.
A lot of beans and tortillas?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing about that experience with Paten Health. That's it's a powerful story. So, yeah, so that's great to hear that you're in connection with them two or three times a week. So you're feeling that soul urge to stay connected. So that's good.
I'm wondering if you might have one compelling story that you could share with us about a patient or client that you helped at Patent Health?
Well, I mean, the one that popped into my head was not a typical case for the community health workers. The community health workers help people every day with the things that they can handle without me. So, you know, they can handle gastrointestinal issues, they can handle pneumonia and asthma and colds and urinary tract infections and, you know, all those things they can handle without me. Actually, I mean, I can tell you a case that they handled without me that was pretty spectacular. So there is a national healthcare system. There is a hospital. Like I said, it's about 4 hours away from where we work. And that's where people go when they need surgery. So there was a boy and he had broken his arm and he needed his arm set, and it was set surgically, and he had pins in his arm. And it was time for the pins to come out. And he and his family had made 3 trips back and forth to the hospital trying to get his pins out. So that's, you know, 3 days that his father had taken off of work and 3 8-hour round trip bus trips and the expenses that go along with that. And they weren't able to get the pins taken out. And so the community health worker, they came to the community health workers and said, you know, can you help us? And I've never taken pins out of an arm, just not something a family medicine doctor's been taught to do. Turns out it's not that hard. But the community health workers just sort of analyzed the situation and cleaned the wound and started wiggling and found out that actually they could take them out. And that was the first time. And they actually just did that again this week. I had a meeting with them at 8:30 on Wednesday morning, and they put me off to 9:15, and it was because there was another situation like that, except now it was complicated by COVID. So people now can't get back and forth to the hospital because with their shelter-in-place orders, public transportation has been shut down, but nobody has cars. So how are you going to get to the hospital if you don't know anybody with a car and there's no public transportation? It's not possible. So the healthcare workers did that again. They've done it a handful of times. So that's the kind of case that they can help with out in the bush, far from true medical care. And I say that again, not far from true medical care. That's not right. So far from official medical care, because they are providing true medical care.
Wow, what a story. So it's kind of like you're a proud mama or something, huh?
Yeah.
Sure. Yes. Oh my gosh, that's a proud mama moment.
Yeah. No. One of the first things that we did when COVID hit was increase the supply of medicines to the health workers in the communities. Like, we're like, okay, you guys are gonna now be doing a lot more work because people can't travel, and so you need supplies. So we boosted their medicine, their pharmacies in the community. That's the first thing. That was our first response to COVID.
That's a wonderful, really like visionary response, knowing that there's going to be issues down the way. So hats off to you, Kate. Mm-hmm. This is a time that we're going to have to take our music break. And when I say have to, is because I'm enjoying our conversation so much, but we do need to take a music break. And you did bring a song for us to listen to tonight and share with us. And I was wondering if you would introduce it for us, why you brought it and why it means something to you.
So the song is called I Hope You Dance, and it's by Leanne Womack. And I heard it for the first time when I had just given birth to my daughter in Guatemala. And there was a CD that had made its way to our house, and somebody put it on for me, and it just embodied all my hopes and desires for her life.
That's beautiful. All right, everyone, enjoy. I Hope You Dance.
I hope you never lose longer. May you never take one single breath for granted. God forbid love ever leave you empty-handed. I hope you still feel small when you stand beside the ocean. Whenever one door closes, I hope one more opens. Promise me that you'll give faith a fighting chance. And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance, I hope you dance. I hope you dance. I hope you never fear those mountains in the distance. Never settle for the path of least resistance. Living might mean taking chances, but they're worth taking. Loving might be a mistake, but it's worth making. Don't let some helping heart leave you bitter. When you come close to selling out, reconsider. Give the heavens above more than just a passing. When you get the choice to sit it out or dance, I hope you do. Promise me that you'll give faith a fighting chance. And when you get the choice to sit it out or dance.
And welcome back, everyone. If you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diana Ann Sheridan, and we are talking with Kate Feibusch. And we just heard the song she brought, which was called I Hope You Dance, in honor of the birth of her daughter. And we just finished talking about her clinic in Guatemala, in Paten, Guatemala, called Paten Health. And it was a fabulous, a fabulous insight to the work, that the good work that she's doing.
So Kate, thank you for all of that, and there's so much more. Especially, I mean, we know that you've been with a woman in Guatemala, so we want to know more about your coming out. When did you know the beginning of your story of becoming, you know, interested in same sex? I want to be respectful and want to know how you identify, if you're open to sharing that. I don't want to label you something that maybe you're not. So so tell us about your coming out.
Okay. I identify as a lesbian. I don't talk about it a lot, but I first got together with a woman in 1990. It was someone that I had met while traveling in East Germany in 1989 before the wall came down. So I got a glimpse into East Germany before the wall came down and met this woman. And we really connected, but it was also a very intense time in East Germany. The East Germans were congregating at the embassy in Hungary and waiting to try to get into the West. I think there was a lot of intensity going on. And this was a person that had very strong opinions about what was going on and a strong analysis and a unique perspective. And we talked a lot about politics and about history and about the future. And it was very exciting and very powerful. And we wrote letters back and forth. Actually, it was my last year of college at Santa Cruz, and I took a quarter to go to Mexico. And so we were writing letters back and forth between East Germany and Mexico, and multiple letters a week. And we chronicled the whole transition of East Germany. And then after about a year of all of this going on, she was able to travel, and she came and visited in the United States. And I was very attracted to her, and we ended up getting together. And she was actually 20 years my senior, but it didn't seem to matter much at the time. I was in my 20s, she was in her 40s, and there was a lot of the world that she hadn't seen because she had lived behind the Iron Curtain, and so she had a very youthful energy. So our courtship was very international. We popped back and forth as often as we could between the United States and Europe, and then eventually figured out a way for her to come to the United States to study. And that's when we started living together. And so that relationship lasted about 7 years.
So was that your coming out? Or did you know before?
Yes.
Really? No relationships in high school?
You didn't? No, that was it.
You didn't see your gym teacher that, you know, most lesbians like, oh, my gym teacher.
I mean, I had a crush on my camp counselor.
How old were you?
10, 11. But I also had some crushes on guys. Sometimes they were gay guys. Sometimes they were guys with other things that made them kind of softer or more vulnerable, health issues. The man that I dated in college, more than dated, when we lived together, was a wheelchair user, also an amazing guy. Very smart, very insightful, had incredible analysis of the world. I learned a lot from him, but I did not think that I was attracted to women at the time.
So did you ever think you were bisexual, or because now you identify as lesbian? I'm just curious about that.
I mean, I think I didn't really think about it that much. I was definitely a tomboy growing up. I remember that one year my dad gave my brother a Boy Scout book and gave me a belt, and I cried because I wanted the Boy Scout book. So I was definitely a tomboy growing up, but I did not particularly, I didn't have any attractions to women that I was able to identify in high school.
Interesting.
I think it's like watching my kids now and just watching how things are different now. I think at the time it was really easy for me to just throw myself into my studies, and that was okay. I didn't have to be sexual. Now there's a lot more room, a lot more discussion about identifying yourself, but also a lot more ways of doing that. So I sometimes actually wonder that if I were born today, if I would have thought about transitioning to male. Because I knew that there was like certainly something different about me in high school. Like I might have thought that I was supposed to be a boy. I'm perfectly happy living as a woman now. I'm kind of androgynous and operate in the world in that way. So I might, you know, 14-year-old me might have thought that I was supposed to be a boy.
Very interesting. I'm curious about your family, your parents, when you had your relationship with the woman from East Germany, and when you were going back and forth between Mexico and East Germany. I'm wondering about family support.
Were you home at the time?
I was not. I was in the end of college and the beginning of medical school. My mom came to terms with it pretty quickly. She can still be a little bit awkward about it. but not some of the hardships that other people have faced. My brother had a little bit more difficulty with it. He's a born-again Christian, and he believes that his faith tells him that that's wrong, and he kind of tried to take a stand once, and that didn't work out so well. So mostly we just don't talk about it, and my dad died when I was 10.
Mm. I want to get back to your brother. I don't know if you want to go deeper into that, but I'm curious when you said he tried to take a stand and that didn't go very well. Can you say more about that? A lot of people, I think, who might be listening have family members who might not accept them, and they're kind of at a loss on what to do. And I'm curious what you did.
This was when I was with the main partner of my life, was my daughter's other mother. And we had come back from Guatemala, and so we didn't have a home in the United States. We were going to be staying with them over Christmas, and he asked that we not sleep in the same room. Mind you, we were sleeping with a four-year-old in sleeping bags on the living room floor. And I said, well, then we can leave. And his wife, who's also a born-again Christian, didn't want me to feel rejected, didn't want to split up the family. So when I said I was going to leave, they recanted and decided that it was okay for us to stay.
Well, good for you to stand up to him and say, hey, yeah, you're going to leave. I think that's good advice for people, because they put themselves in difficult situations and you're just like not denying yourself and you're leaving. I'm curious about, Kate, you said you don't talk about this much. So I know we would like to know more about what is that for you? Because you've had babies with the woman, with women. You have a partner, long-term partner you've had, a couple. So I'm just curious more about what is that part of you that says you don't talk about it much? How can you not talk about it much?
So I'm currently single. And I have been for a good long time. So my life revolves around my kids and my mom and my work in Guatemala. And the fact that I'm a lesbian is. It's not something I'm currently working through. It just is. And so there's not that much to talk about. I think actually it's similar, and this is kind of important to me. A lot of my patients are gay and lesbian, and a lot of them are elders, because as it turns out, Sonoma County has a lot of old lesbians and gay men. And as people get older, especially if they've lost their partner or they've separated from their partner, there's just not that much to talk about. It's still no less a part of who they are, but it just doesn't come up. So as physicians, we're taught about taking a sexual history, and that has a lot to do with talking about people's risks of STDs and other aspects of sexual health. And that's fine. That's all well and good. And we kind of drift off of doing that when people are in their 70s and 80s. And maybe we shouldn't. Maybe it still is important to ask. But beyond the actual sexual behaviors, I think people's identities are important. I'm thinking particularly of a gentleman who kind of recently passed away after COVID started, but not of COVID. And he was an older white guy who worked in the casinos. And I, you know, had my certain stereotype of who this man was. And I took care of him. And there was something that I just kind of wasn't getting about him. And I finally, after like the third or fourth time I saw him, I asked him, like, when he was younger, who he had partnered with. And it turned out that he identified as bisexual, but that his whole adulthood had been defined by the HIV epidemic in San Francisco. So he was one of these guys that has lost dozens and dozens of friends and now finds himself alone and as a low-income elder who has to work in the casinos to make ends meet to put food on the table. And again, we didn't talk about it much, but just me knowing who he was, just me being able to see him was really important for our relationship and really deepened our doctor-patient relationship. So that's a tangent. But I mean, I think I right now for me, that's kind of where I am in some ways. It's like, yes, I'm a lesbian. That's who I am. It's not something I need to talk about. It just is me. Like being right-handed. I mean, I don't talk about being right-handed, but I am.
So that's basically how we feel too, mostly.
Yeah. And we don't go around telling everyone. It just is what it is. So I totally understand what you're saying, Kate.
I mean, if I had a partner, it would be a different situation. When I was living in Sonoma County, I was not living closeted. I was open about the fact that I was partnered with a woman.
So that was obvious too.
Yeah. It's a lot easier to come out when you're just introducing your partner.
But I want to get back to the gentleman that you were speaking of. What a gift to him for you to be interested and curious about his life, not to make judgments about it to him, to totally understand, to have your relationship deepened, for him not to feel so alone. What a gift. I can't imagine having a gay doctor. I've never had a gay doctor.
You've never known that you had a gay doctor.
Well, all the doctors have, you know, my husband this, my husband that, or my wife this, my wife that. I mean,
it might be cover up.
You know,
we know about that too, right, Kate?
Now there are a few of us. Sonoma County has a fair number of mostly lesbian. There's a few gay men, but mostly there's a lot of lesbian doctors here.
Well, I just think it'd be really, really great for me to have a lesbian or gay doctor, because I don't know, I just feel like it'd be more less of something and more of something, and I can't find the right words, like less stressful and more accepting. Maybe
Kate probably has a line of people waiting, a list of on the waiting list for her, right, Kate?
Well, but Kayla, who you interviewed I believe last month or the month before,
yes,
Kayla Flores Tyndall is my new practice partner at Kaiser, and her panel is wide open, I think.
Aha. Good to know. Good to know. So we are wondering about kids and being a parent. Tell us a little bit about your children.
And how it started. How did you decide that you wanted to have kids and all of that?
I have always known that I wanted children. I watched a documentary when I was in high school called Who Are the Devolts and Where Did They Get 20 Children? And I thought that was fabulous. And so I always kind of had adoption in the back of my mind. And when I bought my first new car, when I was in residency and finally earning some money, I bought a Subaru wagon thinking that I was going to put a stroller in the back of it. And then I met my partner and she had a four-year-old. And so I didn't put a stroller in the back, I put a big wheel in the back and began to parent her biological child. And we were together for 10 years, so I got to raise her from 4 to 14. And then we went down to Guatemala when her child was 7. And we actually went down with papers in place to adopt. That was our plan. And when we were down there, we realized that a couple of white women living in rural Guatemala with an adopted Guatemalan child was probably not going to be safe. And so we changed our plans and decided that I was going to have a baby, which I did. And that's my older daughter, Toby, who's 17. And then we continued our lives down there until Toby was 6. And then my partner and I ended up splitting up. And she and her daughter came up to live in the States because it was time for her to go to high school. And Toby and I returned to Guatemala. And that's when we adopted Kathy. Kathy was 5 at the time. So my girls are 18 months apart. And we have been a threesome ever since.
And your adopted daughter's name is?
Kathy.
How do you spell that?
C-A-T-Y. Kind of like Katie, but pronounced with a Guatemalan accent.
I see. Kathy. Kathy. Got it. Okay. Ah. So how was that being a gay parent? I know you don't really talk about it much, but I mean, you are a gay parent and getting them in school and dealing with homophobia in the schools. And did you have to go on that journey with your kids?
Not too much. So families in Guatemala are a little bit fluid anyway, in that people are often raised by their grandparents. So, you know, the idea of having mama and mamita is not unusual. And we might as well have been from the moon anyway. So we didn't have to live by the same set of standards that the locals had to adhere to, because people just figured, oh, that's the way Americans do things. So we did not face much homophobia down there at all.
And what about here, when you got back here and there in school and stuff?
Well, once we got back here, I was a single mom. We didn't have to think about it very much. I was just like every other single mom.
So you say you're a single mom. You've been that way, the three of you, for a while now. and that's your choice, or are you looking, or what's going on with that piece of your life, Kate?
So as I came back to the United States in 2012, well, a few years before I came back, I was in a long distance relationship with someone up here, and that's one of the many reasons that I came back, was to pursue that relationship. We thought it would be smart to all move in together all at once, me and my two kids and her two kids, right after I got back from Guatemala. We did the classic lesbian U-Haul thing, which was not smart, and lasted about a year. And so once that relationship dissolved, and since then I've been single. And I guess what one of the things that that relationship taught me was that it's not only about me forming a relationship with a future partner. It's about each of my kids forming a relationship with that person. And in the prior case, each of her kids forming a relationship with the three of us as well. So it gets really complicated. And I just was prioritizing my kids. And I still do. I still do. I mean, they're getting to the age where they don't need me to prioritize them quite as much. But it made more sense for me to invest in my relationship with them as they were growing and meeting me and changing and developing into young adults. And we've got a lot of time left over. I mean, I'm a single mom 100% of the time. So there's not a lot of bandwidth left over for dating. I can see like a potential light at the end of the tunnel if COVID goes away and we're able to go away to college. Certainly there will be time for me in my personal life. So, you know, someday in the future, yes, but I'm not sure that now is quite the time yet.
Very interesting. We are at the end of our show, Kate. And so we are wondering if you might have a couple words of wisdom for our listening audience. Anything you'd like them to know?
You know, you prepped me on this question and I thought about it. And I kind of went back into doctor mode. I would just encourage people to like not go into their 80s with the plan of living by themselves in a house, especially if that house has two stories. But just like make a different plan. Like that plan's not going to go well. And it's something that I see in clinic, all of my colleagues and I see in clinic every single day. And people should just realize that that plan's not going to go well and make a different one. You know, have a situation where you have people around you, or you know, if it's not family, if it's not biological family, then family of choice, or some other situation. But don't be the person that is living alone in a house when you're, you know, well into your 80s.
Mm. Beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how beautiful it was. It's more practical.
We hear your heart, Kate. That's why when we say beautiful or something like that, we just hear your heart. And I know there's a longer story behind that, because you say you see something that is not good, is not workable. And so as a doctor, you hear and see things that you're speaking from your heart about. So that's what we're responding to. So there's a lot of single individuals living alone, and it makes us think about us. But yeah, thank you for it. Yeah, no wonder you're sticking tight to your girls. You better get, you know, they're going to grow up and they're going to have to leave, Kate. So you're going to have to do what you're preaching, right?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I my mom lives two miles from us, you know, and we did that on purpose, because as she starts to have issues, we're right here to be able to take care of her. And I remind my kids that it's on them to take care of me.
It's fantastic. It's a great learning opportunity for your children to see you take care of your mom. So anyway, thank you so much for being a wonderful, wonderful guest on our show. We really want to thank you for your time and your stories and sharing your life with us a little bit.
Yeah. Thank you, Kate. And thank you for your service and all the work that you're doing out in the world. Really, a lot of important stuff. So thank you.
Thank you for listening.
And we want our listeners to remember that, like Kate, you too can be living proof that through sharing your passion, your creative expression, you can make our world a better world. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we will be back next month. Until then,
Good night.
Reflections of the fears I know I've left behind. I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending. I'm on my way. Can't stop me now. And you can.
Next Sunday night for Outbeat Music with Cheryl Cabanuck. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on Radio 91. And remember, online, on air, and on the go, we are Radio 91 KRCB-FM Windsor and K215CQ Santa Rosa, a service of Northern California Public Media. It is 9 p.m. Stay with us. Afropop is next.